Welcome to Intelligent Systems, the podcast of the Institute for Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis. I am your host, Dr. Leah Windsor. I am the director of the Institute for Intelligent Systems and associate professor of applied linguistics at the University of Memphis. I study language and society. My work explores the question, how does what we say reveal who we are? In this podcast, we will explore the dynamics of intelligent systems, including interactions between and among humans, computers, and groups of sentient and non-sentient beings. The Institute for Intelligent Systems has three key areas: language, learning, and artificial intelligence. We will explore and define what an intelligent system is and talk about intelligent systems in practice across these three issue areas. Today's guest is Dr. Art Gracer. Dr. Gracer is a professor emeritus in the Department of Psychology and the Institute for Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis, and is an honorary research fellow in the Department of Education at the University of Oxford. He received his PhD in psychology from the University of California at San Diego. Art's primary research interests are in cognitive science, discourse processing, and the learning sciences. More specific interests include knowledge representation, question asking and answering, tutoring, text comprehension, inference generation, conversation, reading, problem solving, memory, emotions, computational linguistics, artificial intelligence, human-computer interactions, and learning technologies with animated conversational agents. Art has been principal investigator or co-PI on 70 grants or contracts, approximately $50 million of external funding for the University of Memphis. This funding has primarily come from the National Science Foundation, Institute of Education Sciences, National Institutes of Health, Office of Naval Research, Army Research Laboratory, and Advanced Distributed Learning. He's published over 700 articles in journals, books, and conference proceedings. Welcome to the Intelligent Systems Podcast, Art. We are so glad to have you as our inaugural guest.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself beyond your bio? What's your academic career? What's your story?
Well, I started out in California at UCSD in San Diego, and that's when the cognitive revolution started. That's really one of the three or four universities that really started that trend and ended up to where there's cognitive science programs throughout the United States. And as you know, cognitive science is a major part of our Institute for Intelligent Systems. And I just wanted to mention, it's very interdisciplinary. That was the thrust.
Yes. Yeah. Exceptionally interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
So what do you think an intelligent system is?
Well, I started thinking about that in 1985 when I arrived here, where there was a group of people, including Stan Franklin, who got a lot of researchers discussing what intelligence is all about. And the best way to start is looking at examples. Look at the human mind, different animals. Also, there's even society. A society can be an example intelligent system. Also, there's artifacts like digital computers. So what is it about them that makes it intelligent?
Right.
And so we started to identify features like memory and perception and adaptation. Which is features that are very important in an intelligent system. And it's got to be able to perceive and sense the world and adapt. And so, you know, that's a big discussion. What are the attributes? And we're still talking about it here in the IIS.
Yes. I mean, it's an incredibly relevant line of questioning. And it seems like learning is really at the core of what you were saying.
Absolutely. And in fact, we wondered whether certain organisms learn or they're just biologically kind of constructed to where they wouldn't learn so much. But that's an issue, you know. Each of those attributes or faculties you can ask is it essential in an intelligent system?
Okay.
And by doing this, you get a better sort of nuanced understanding what intelligence is all about. But none of us believe you can define intelligence as you would in a dictionary.
Huh.
It's really more complex than that. It's an ever-going evolutionary exploration.
So it would be hard to do a 30-second elevator pitch on what an intelligent system is because it's so big.
Yes, but you could do an elevator pitch on examples.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes when you don't have a crisp definition, you can provide examples.
So that leads to my next question. What is an example of an intelligent system from your work? What do intelligent systems look like in the research that you do and that you've done in your career?
Well, I have worked a lot with agents, mm-hmm. conversational agents. And they can be talking heads, or they can just be a system that interacts with a person.
Mm-hmm.
And an agent has a number of characteristics. Stan Franklin and I wrote on that many mm-hmm. years ago. It has to sense the environment.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have a goal. It has to interact and communicate in some way. It has to learn. It has to have a memory. It has to have a lot of those characteristics
mm-hmm.
of intelligence that we just talked about. And so one of the systems was AutoTutor,
uh-huh.
where people learn by holding a conversation in natural language,
uh-huh.
because that's how people learn for millennia, conversations. And so many people in the population, that's their preferred way of learning. And so we built systems, tested them out, and found that these auto-tutor-like systems with agents help people learn. Yeah.
That makes me think about the various chatbots in different societies that people who are lonely can interact with, and they seem very real.
Yes. And there is a need, namely, tutors are hard to get.
Yeah.
And once a person is a tutor, there's a fast dropout rate.
Yeah.
And so this is a way to help various populations learn about topics. And we actually produced systems that were equivalent in helping people learn to actually accomplish tutors.
Huh.
And tutoring is much better than classroom. We've got data than that. And much better than reading, just have people reading. Yet what happens most in schools, it's people are in classrooms listening to lectures, or the assigned readings are expected to be read. Are they read? But
is but the syllabus
when
read?
You compare these interactive tutors to reading an equivalent amount of time,
yeah.
there's a substantial improvement.
That's amazing. I mean, what you're saying about tutors being hard to find and the attrition rate within an auto tutor system, the computer doesn't get tired, right?
Right.
The computer will keep going as long as you want to, I imagine. So the fatigue or the availability, you know, having to schedule with a live person. So do the people who use AutoTutor experience it as they would a conversation with another human?
Well, our early systems just had people typing in,
mm-hmm.
you know, keyboard entry. But the AutoTutor would speak and have facial expressions. But a colleague of mine, Sidney DeMello,
uh-huh.
Had a version with speech recognition. And on a different system, so did Andrew Olney.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Andrew Olney had a comical system of the talking fish. Do you remember Billy Bass.
I have one at home.
Yes, he actually hooked that up to AutoTutor on physics. It's what I call the physics tutor. And I've demoed that at places, and it illustrates the conversational exchange between AutoTutor. And AutoTutor doesn't simply lecture. It helps the students do the talking and acting. It gives hints. The goal is for a collaborative partner for the student to think through and learn and that sort of thing.
Huh. Yeah. I wanted to hook up my Billy Bass fish to the Amazon thing. I wonder if Andrew could help me with that.
Oh, he's very gifted at technology. And when he was hired, he actually, what he wanted to buy is a 3D printer.
Ah.
And that's before people really knew about 3D printers.
But, he's always been on the cutting edge. But, you know, I think that's also emblematic of what the IIS has stood for the last several decades. And I think it would be really interesting to talk about how the IIS got started and the conversations, how the conversations coalesced. How did it come to be? What was the process?
Well, very interestingly, when I arrived in 1985, that's when it started. But it wasn't really me who was the catalyst. It really was Stan Franklin, who actually would have AI lunches where every Wednesday in the afternoon, actually around noon, we'd sit around a table and talk about intelligence and ideas and AI. And we did that for a long time. Lots of researchers in different departments. And so it really started grassroots. And so one day, three of us went for a jog in Overton Park. It was Stan Franklin, it was Terry Horgan, who was in philosophy.
Okay.
By the way, Stan Franklin was in math and computer science. I was in psychology, and then we had also Terry Horgan in philosophy, because philosophers want to talk about the nature of intelligence.
Yes.
And so we jogged and said, why don't we start an institute? And so we did. And we called it the Institute for Intelligent Systems, and we added on another person with us, Don Franceschetti, who was in physics.
Yes.
So these are a lot of the components that really generated, cognitive science and a lot of the efforts. So we did that. And by 1987, we managed to get it approved as an institute by the Tennessee Board of Regents.
Oh, yes.
You remember those days
of
TBR?
Yes.
And so we did that. And fortunately, Andy Myers, who was chair of psychology and also part of the Center for Applied Psychological Research, really supported the IIS missions.
Yeah.
When we started, we didn't get any funding from them. It was just grassroots, and we eventually got a cognitive science seminar. And but then we ended up applying for all these grants because we had a common vision. All these discussions, where we didn't get paid for it. We had to pay for it. We had to buy our lunch. But ideas percolated. And so we started applying for grants, and we became successful. And we ended up being eventually a major magnet for funding, and we're number one kind of, group on campus in bringing in grant money for a while, at least a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you had good infrastructure for that, too. I think that one of the things that the IIS does really well is look toward the future and the IIS has always really seen what's on the horizon. And so even the infrastructure for personnel in the IIS, like, in, you know, starting the pre-award coordinator position to help facilitate collaborations, grant-funded collaborations between faculty. I think that that forward-looking and visionary openness to ideas and collaboration, all of those things really continue to define the IIS and interdisciplinarity too.
Absolutely. And we became successful with these grants.
Yes.
Very successful, to the point where the university, various people in the university wanted to support us. So eventually they saw the vision on how important this was.
Yeah.
So we got faculty.
Yeah.
We got support for writing grants, administering grants.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually software experts, because with all these grants, after the grant finishes, you want them to continue, these various artifacts to continue. So it was very important to have these software engineers have some sort of continuity.
So in thinking about contemporary society, what contemporary problems do you think the IIS can help to address, or what can the IIS help us understand about society?
Well, I know we're right in the middle of the generative AI kind of evolution or revolution, whatever you want to call it. It's certainly disruptive with ChatGPT and large language models.
Right.
A couple of points there. A lot of the large language models like ChatGPT, the developers don't know much about conversation and learning. For example, the original ChatGPT, it's the human who had to ask all the questions to get any responses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing we know is people aren't very, we have research on this, mm-hmm. people are not very good at asking questions. Partly because if you grew up in classroom environments where the rate of teacher questions is high, the rate of students' questions is near zero.
Yes.
And so people, we want them to be good question asker, but we know from research they don't do that very well.
Right.
The original ChatGPT, the people didn't realize that if you want to improve it for learning.
Uh-huh.
So then OpenAI opened up, here is a prompt to be a tutor. Well, that prompt that a lot of people have used had the computer asking most of the questions and grilling them. What you want is a mixed initiative dialogue where sometimes students introduce topics and ask questions, and sometimes the computer system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you need a theory, a good theory based on research on how conversation proceeds and in order to improve these generative AI systems and large language models like ChatGPT and others like it.
And so I think juxtaposing where we are right now versus where things were in 1985 when you and Stan and Don and
Don Francisco and Terry Horgan.
Yes, Terry Horgan. Yeah. Where you sat around and talked and imagined and problem solved. I feel like right now the technology has outpaced our ability to sit back and reflect. And, you know, in academia, we are rewarded by the things that we produce, not just the ideas that we have in our head or the conversations that we have. They have to lead to something. And it feels like the technology is moving so fast and the theory and the reflection is not keeping pace with that. And I think you're absolutely right that the interrogation of these systems, they're not inherently bad or wrong, but we need more reflection about their meaning and our relationships with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the philosophy perspective, the trolley car problem used to be entirely theoretical, right? Now, mm-hmm. with driverless cars, it's not at all theoretical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that one of the things that the IIS can continue to do is to serve as a place where people can think about big ideas and be a home for intellectual curiosity on its own, as its own thing. And maybe it leads to something, but I think the beauty of how the IIS was created was that it was so organic. It was not fixated on any particular singular goal. It just evolved.
And that's why you point out something very important, the evolution of mm-hmm. knowledge. That's why we had the cognitive science seminar. Every semester, a different topic would come up.
Yes.
And notice that's different than yes. where you have a fixed curriculum.
Yes.
Where you have to go through and get accreditation or approval for everything. That's not the way. That's a very 20th century idea, maybe even a 19th century idea. You need a way of articulating and reflecting on new things that are coming up. And that's where the cognitive science seminar has that capacity. And every semester it's different, a different theme,
yes.
and it reflects the future.
And it's not so focused on the canonical literature. There's some of that, but it's also the cutting edge literature yep. as mm-hmm. well. So the three key areas of the IIS are language, learning, and artificial intelligence. What do you think are the exciting things on the horizon for these various areas for language, learning, and AI?
Well, I do believe in the whole multiple agent architectures
mm-hmm.
where humans are an agent.
Mm-hmm.
One of these talking heads is an agent. They have abstract software agents
mm-hmm.
where that just compute things and they don't have a persona. I think one of the big things for the future is to understand multiple agent architectures,
hmm.
hybrids between humans and computer systems.
Hmm.
For example, take a small group interaction, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's a study group or whether it's collaborative problem solving. And a lot of humans don't, collaborate very well. Sometimes they have groupthink where they just want an easy solution in order to go home and get out of the group. Others have a lot of fights and antagonisms. Imagine if they have a computer agent that mm-hmm. helps guide, referee, make suggestions, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, I think that's going to happen in the future. Unfortunately, the ones in the past, agents, like if you go into a car, they have a talking head that'll drive you nuts. That didn't learn.
Right.
And so you want an agent that can learn and adapt. And we're just exploring the different multiple agent architectures right now in the world. Mm-hmm. And, what do they call it? Where one artifact talks to another
uh-huh.
artifact, talks to a human,
uh-huh.
The Internet of Things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of these are examples of multiple agent architectures. We just have to understand them more and
yeah.
how they help humans, hurt humans, and we don't know. You
yeah.
mentioned earlier a lot of these things, we just don't know.
Yeah.
So I do worry about people coming up with policies too early without checking out the
mm-hmm.
implications of those policies.
Mm-hmm.
Like a school system says you're not allowed to use ChatGPT. That is too brittle. That is not going to have legs in the future.
And also, along with that, teaching the critical thinking to be able to interrogate the computer-generated information to understand whether or not that's a hallucination or it's an actual thing. And, you know, I think what you were saying about helping groups collaborate, there's so little attention to the group dynamics in collaboration and the science of teams. And that's a really interesting point that an artificial agent could help a team collaborate better. You know, this is a role of a facilitator who serves as a neutral party to help help a group get from point A to point B, or develop an idea or a vision or a mission statement. And that would be a really interesting role.
It's a role I've had passion about for the last decade. I was a co-chair for PISA collaborative problem solving. This is that international assessment, student assessment. For 15-year-olds who assess them. And by the way, in that assessment, they interacted with agents.
Okay.
You know, because, well, for various reasons. But one of the things that we've learned in the collaborative problem-solving assessment is that in most countries, people aren't very good at it, even though it is essential in modern everyday interactions in industry, business, and everything. Collaborative problem solving is very key. We don't have a curriculum for it. So that's a big question, just like critical thinking. They've tried in colleges and some high schools to have critical thinking courses, but there wasn't a lot of agreement in what to put there. And so people wonder, how do you help people learn critical thinking skills and collaborative problem-solving skills? How do you do that? And that's still a mystery.
Well, I mean, as you pointed out earlier, the prevailing model of classroom instruction is where the teacher asks most of the questions and the students respond. And so it seems like there would have to be a shift even younger and in the structure of classroom engagement to where it's more balanced between who's asking the questions, which might feel a little chaotic.
That's where you need technology.
Yeah.
Could you imagine 30 students in a classroom all asking the teacher questions simultaneously? That's logistically impossible.
Yeah.
Of course, for many millennium, the way people learned is through one-on-one tutoring, mentoring, small groups sometimes.
Right.
Classrooms came up during the Industrial Revolution to train people efficiently. Unfortunately, most of that knowledge is for shallow knowledge. Classrooms are great for exposure to shallow knowledge. It isn't equipped at all for gaining deeper knowledge, where you might need computer simulations and work like what-if scenarios, or making things, creating things. And that's what I loved about the IIS. With all, you'd have all these grant projects where people would create computer artifacts or whatever artifacts, and that was a collaborative enterprise, and you get deeper knowledge when you have to make things. Let's put it this way. If your car breaks down, would you rather go to a person who actually can make things or just measure things? Or, you know, you ask question, how do you get deep knowledge in the 21st century? It's hard. But classroom lectures are fine for exposure, very good for exposure, but that's not where you get deep knowledge at all.
Yeah.
And even in labs, you know, in chemistry and biology and physics, labs are fine, but they're usually just pre, you know, they're existing problems in the curriculum, as opposed to an inquiry where you're trying to learn something new, experimental.
Where you don't have the answer.
Right.
You know, the fixed item choices are efficient, but the real world is much more complicated and more interesting when you don't have the answer.
Yep.
I taught a freshman honors course on a mysterious medieval manuscript of unknown origin a couple of semesters ago. And the first day of class, I said, I have no idea what this is about. We're just going to explore this together. The students were kind of taken aback. You know, I'm up there in front of the classroom. I should have some idea of what I'm doing. And I did. You know, I had an idea of how we would go about exploring it, but I didn't have a preconceived or predetermined answer for them to arrive at. And so on the last day of class, I asked what they had learned. And one of the students who had been pretty skeptical and, you know, play things by the book, said, I learned that sometimes you don't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Mm-hmm. Class dismissed. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
And living in the world, the one worry about that fundamental epistemology
mm-hmm.
is when you consider science, people might say, well, you don't have all the answers. So what is the role of science in society?
Yep.
But you look at what it's brought us.
Yeah.
We need to be reminded of what it has brought us, whether it's curing bacterial infections, mm-hmm. viruses, taking us to the moon,
mm-hmm.
You know, helping poverty.
Yeah.
Of course, all of us in the IIS love science, and I think the kind of dynamic nature of the training and research in the Institute for Intelligent Systems is what the essence of what higher education should be all about.
Yes, that mm-hmm. science is not a fixed end, it's a moving target.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That it's something that you're constantly chasing and updating.
Yeah.
So my last question for you, what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm in the middle of my sixth year of retirement, you know, so, and I thought that I'd just be able to stop doing research, but unfortunately, I'm still working on grants, leading none of them. I'm just a team player. Sometimes I advise, sometimes I just co-learn.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that's good is I get to read a lot.
Oh.
Like I've been reading the books of, you know, Ray Kurzweil and Harari.
Okay.
Yuval Noah Harari, and a recent one by Terence Sijnowski on ChatGPT and the future of AI. So I get to read more.
Huh.
But I've been giving keynotes and mm-hmm. symposium presentations at a variety of conferences. And I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
I love it. Well, Art, it has been a treat to hang out with you this afternoon and hear your wisdom. And I'm just so grateful for everything that you've done for the IIS and the University of Memphis and the city and community of Memphis and our neighborhood.
And thanks to you for organizing this series, podcast series. I think it's very important. And I look forward to seeing how it evolves under your new leadership.
Thank you, Art. Theme music for the Intelligent Systems podcast was created by Jason David Cooper.